experience this full sellout crowd and yeah, flares the lot.
You must be looking forward to it because this will be like nothing you've experienced then.
No, yeah, absolutely not. I remember playing a Greek side, PAOK, in the Europa League, and it was mental. Like, I mean, like walking out to look at the pitch an hour and a half before kickoff, and everyone was in the stadium. There were flares, they were whistling. It was, and I can't wait to experience that again. But as a home team player, so yeah, we watched a derby in a hotel, Fenerbahce Galatasaray on the weekend, which was, as you can imagine, it was a fiery encounter. So yeah, I'm looking forward to playing Jose Mourinho's Fener.
Finished Fenerbahce 1, Galatasaray 3 that. And afterwards, Galatasaray dubbed Mourinho the crying one because he left without doing a match press conference. You're going to have a lot of fun, aren't you? Andros, thank you very much. Rory as well. And Chris, we will do it all again next week. Thank you for listening and watching. 7 o'clock next Monday, we will be back. Next up on 5 Live Sport, we'll do 5 Live Boxing after Jill McKenzie.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes are now known to have killed more than 350 people. 1,200 are said to have been injured. It's the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly two decades. The Lebanese health minister is Firas Aviad.
Our understanding is that there has been over 500 airstrikes in different locations, whether in southern Lebanon, in Bika, and also in other areas. The vast majority, if not all, of the sites that were targeted were civilian. Some of them were residential buildings. And we had this number of casualties really mounting very fast.
Speaking in the last hour, the Israeli Defense Force spokesperson, Daniel Hagari, said the fighting would continue until Israel believed its citizens in the north of the country were safe from attack.
We are not looking for wars. We are looking to take down the threats. And there will not be a 7th of October threat in the northern border. It have to be a safe border where Hezbollah is pushed back from the border and there are no threats like missiles, rockets, UAVs threatening our communities, our citizens.
Rachel Reeves says there'll be no return to austerity. In her first speech to a Labour Party conference as Chancellor, she said tough decisions were needed to deal with the economic legacy left by the Conservative government. Rob Wood is the Chief Economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics.
She talked about the need to boost investment, about the need for stability. But underlying all that, not really very much changed. The government is still heading towards tax hikes in this next budget. They're not going to be on income tax, national insurance or VAT, so they will be elsewhere. And the government faces a very difficult fiscal outlook, which will require those tax hikes to balance.
US prosecutors say they'll seek to charge the suspect found hiding with a gun at Donald Trump's Florida golf course with attempting to assassinate a major political candidate. Investigators have released a letter written by Ryan Ruth months ago, which said he planned to kill Mr. Trump. Nurses in England have rejected the government's offer of a 5.5% pay rise. The Royal College of Nursing said a record number of its members voted on the deal and two-thirds were against it. The Culture Secretary is Lisa Nandy.
We'll get around the table, we'll talk to the nurses, but obviously we were elected to fix the foundations. We've got a £22 billion black hole this year alone. We've got to make some difficult choices, but already the Chancellor has announced an above-inflation pay rise for all public sector workers, including nurses.
Harrods is starting an internal review looking at whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations relating to Mohamed Al-Fayed. A former employee has told BBC News a manager who failed to investigate allegations of inappropriate behaviour still works for the company. And two Russian cosmonauts have landed back on Earth after a record-breaking stay aboard the International Space Station. They spent 374 days there. That's the longest ever continuous stint.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Keeping you up to date with everything Formula One.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was an amazing race. A few too many close calls. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
Next up, Austin, Texas, and an intense six-race sprint to the end of the year.
The Checkered Flag Podcast.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
This is Five Live Boxing.
Yes, Five Live Boxing with me, Mark Chapman. Between now and 10, we will talk about that incredible night at Wembley on Saturday that saw Daniel Dubois retain his world heavyweight title by doing something no one had done before him, knocking out Anthony Joshua. We'll look at what happened in the ring, what Dubois did right, what Joshua did wrong, and we'll look at the future for both fighters. We'll hear from both camps. We'll hear from Joshua himself, Eddie Hearn, and Frank Warren on what was a remarkable night. We need big guests with us, Mike Costello and Steve Bunce in the studio. So you gave yourself a big build-up there.
Well, you gave me a big build-up. I just showed you what you do when you, when you're called a big guest. You have to just pump it up a little bit, chappers. You understand me?
First of all,
could I apologise again? Can I apologise again for Saturday when I called you Fletch instead of chappers? Well, I am really sorry about that.
It's absolutely fine.
No, it's not.
I don't want you to feel guilty about it.
I can tell from your voice it's not.
But it's good to keep winding him up about it for a while, Mike. I tend to find. Listen, I didn't hold it against you because on Saturday night afterwards, I then texted you simply, wow.
Yeah.
And you said, I think it needs a bit more than that.
Yeah, it's the truth, yeah. That's the absolute. I had a couple of wows and I said to the same people, no, it needs more than wow what we've just witnessed.
But it was one of those nights where you can't resist texting and messaging.
Yeah.
And I remember when Usain Bolt won his first 100 metres in Beijing. People were texting me, mates and family texting me saying, did you see that? Well,
I was 48 feet away from the finish line.
So, but even for you two, as experienced as you are, and as you say, Mike, doing, you know, we all do lots of other sports. Was it a wow moment for you? A wow night for you?
This was really special. The occasion was massive, but it's not always the case, is it, Steve, that the fight
lives up to the occasion.
The night. This time it did, and it's heavyweight boxing, and you've got that notion that the next punch might be the last. And that was the feeling all the way throughout this until the last punch. With heavyweight boxing, there's this added dimension when you just don't know that it's going to end. And I got there really early in the stadium, Mark. You do a lot of work in football. I've been in Olympic stadiums covering athletics, and depending on where the action is and where your commentary position is, you can be 50 yards away from the action. But we were down there. I was working with Darren Barker, former world middleweight champion, who's a massive Chelsea fan. And we got there very early on, no one in the stands, and we're standing at ringside. So basically, we're on the centre circle.
Yeah.
And we just started fantasising about the Euros and England against Italy 2021 and the penalty shootout. And where we were standing is probably where
the players were arm in arm.
Penalty takers were on each team. And you just imagine, you look around. I mean, I'm shivering now. You look around at these banks of seats. Everybody sat in those will be looking at you as you take that stride towards the penalty spot and knowing that one strike can change how you're remembered. And the boxers were coming in the other direction, so almost from the goal mouth to the centre circle, climbing up to the ring. And again, one shot, one strike, and it could determine how they're remembered.
And they're on their own, chappers, on that walk, not just on Saturday night. They're on their own when you sit there and watch them. And I'm a big fan of watching them. I like to watch them. The moment I see their heads pop up from the tunnel or behind a curtain at York Hall or just at the back of the Murky Hall, wherever it is, I want to watch them. I want to see if they're inhaling. I want to see if they look fidgety. I want to see, like, Frank Bruno when he walked to slaughter against Mike Tyson in their second fight, when he crossed himself either 63 times or 64 times. It's a blur, his hand, as he's crossing himself. I want to see those close to their faces in their eyes during that walk, because that last leg of the walk, if you can imagine, you're 50 metres back and the ring's big, but it's not that big, and it just gets bigger until in the end you're in the middle of it, and there's not that many people in the ring before a fight, maybe five or six people floating around. And that moment when the lights are on, and I'm still watching them. I mean, I might ignore it. Mike might have been next to me when we did all the comms. And I might be talking, but I'm not looking at him. I'm looking at the guy in the ring. I want to see something. And listen, I'm not saying I'm a genius at reading body language, but I'm fairly good at it. And that's when you see it.
And again, going back to the fact that we all do an awful lot of sports and different sports, before we get to the actual fight itself, the other thing that struck me on Saturday was actually the whole event and how slick it was and stage managed it was. And look, I know there's a lot of money behind it to the extent that money is no object. But, you know, I've been to cup finals where the artist performing's got stuck in the dressing room and the halftime show starts 5 minutes late. Or, you know, the fireworks are like three that go off at the boundary and that's it. You know, sport wants big shows now. They want to be slick. The undercard, the staging, the mute. People could have their opinions on Liam and whatever, but, you know, three big Oasis songs from just so much of it all came together.
Well, what happens, Chubbers? That was the seventh, what we call Riyadh season show. Five have been in Riyadh, obviously. One was in Los Angeles in early August, and then there's this one. And the people organising it, and people just say, oh, you know, the Saudi Arabian organisers. No, the people organise it. It's the best people from Eddie Hearn's company. It's the best people from Frank Warren's company. Now, both of those individual companies, Matchroom and Queensbury, have promoted their own independent outdoor shows during the last 12 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. They've dealt with enormous cards. They've dealt with 80,000, 90,000, 78,000 crowds. They're the best in the business at what they do. In fact, if you're putting on a sporting event, you'd hire either of those as a consultant. So that's why, Chappers, we've got to this slick point when, you know, Liam's due at whatever it was, 10:02, and he's out at 10:02, and he's a rock star, by the way, so he's not meant to be on time, and he's not meant to finish 3 seconds late, and then leave the stage, and he's not. So all the things happen, and they don't happen by chance. They happen by experience, and that's what Warren and Eddie Hearn have got between them at these big events. I mean, we've been blessed in this country in this last decade with the super fights. We've had more super fights outdoors in front of 60,000 plus in the last 10 years than we had in the previous 50 years. Go figure that one. And that's a genuine stat. We're the kings at it. The Americans can't do it. The Saudis couldn't do it on their own. We, the Germans, are not bad at it, but they're not us. We are the absolute kings at doing what you saw the other night.
And right down to the finest detail. I mean, even when I walked in at about 1 o'clock and Liam Gallagher was rehearsing, they were doing a sound check and they did all three numbers. So I lifted my phone and I've got this video that's 3 seconds long. By the time I'd got from like waist height to holding it up to take film of the stage, I'd been jumped on by security. So I've got this wobbly film that's 3 seconds long. So, I mean, the detail all the way from, you know, from start to finish is incredible.
God, I was in Ticketmaster queues for days trying to get that kind of experience that you got on your own as he rehearsed those.
That's the truth.
Those three. I know. Tell me about it. Look, onto the fight itself, and I'm going to leave the fifth round until a little while. But onto the fight itself, as a complete whole, how good a fight was it?
This is what I think is really interesting, because it's being described as a great fight. And great fights include action which sways one way, then the other, and back again, quite often more than once. And once, for me, Anthony Joshua took a heavy shot after 25 seconds and then was floored at the end of the opening round. And for me, for most of the time after that, it was Dubois on top. Now, that doesn't take away, as I was saying earlier, from that kind of heavyweight sense of drama. But there weren't many occasions during the contest, especially after that first round knockdown, when I truly believed that Joshua would make his way back. When he had a quiet 2 minutes in the fourth round and then went back to his corner, and the corner were then asking him to start rolling the dice, that's when I thought there might be a chance now to start to turn it around. And interestingly, in the Dubois corner, there's been a lot of coverage of what was said in Anthony Joshua's corner before what was ultimately the final round. But in Dubois' corner, Don Charles, who appeared on a brilliant podcast, I have to say, with Steve a couple of weeks ago, in the Dubois corner, said to him, with real urgency, don't throw this away. Don't let him back in. And sometimes you only need a simple command like that. To the outside world, anybody can say that. But that's sometimes all it needs. It doesn't need, you know, throw this shot, throw that shot, move back, bob and weave. At that stage of a contest, it's so heady and there's so much going on in the mind of a boxer that simple commands like that can be absolutely crucial.
Costello is so desperate to go to the break at the end of the fourth round and into the fifth round. If you put a restraining reins around him, you'd need five men to hold him back. He is absolutely, you know, chomping at a bit. I've never seen him chomp quite like this. So I'm going to take you back to the first round, if you don't mind. It's going to be really painful for you the next 2 minutes, Mike, I can assure you. First round, absolutely right. Mike picked up on it very early in the fight, 23, 24 seconds, according to the clock. AJ gets clumped with a really good right hand, and he shakes to his body. His legs don't wobble, but you see him shake, and we can see it. We've seen it enough. Their body literally shakes on the spot. He just about survives to the bell when he gets dropped with a massive looping shot, and he goes down into the ropes, literally as the bell's sounding. Gets through that round. There's genuine bedlam and mayhem in that one. In the second round, he does survive. He stays on his feet in the second round. But he is being not necessarily punched from pillar to post, but he's offering very little, and he's taking enough so that every time he's clipped anywhere above the chest, he looks hurt, and he looks, frankly, Chappers, like he's in danger of toppling over. And then in the third round, right on the bell, he does go down again. And that's the second knockdown. And that count finishes actually in the break between the third and the fourth. And I've built a case here, and I'm not quite sure Mike's absolutely buying into it. I've built a sort of 80 seconds, an extraordinary 80 seconds of boxing. It starts at the end of the third round. The 80 seconds starts at the end of the third round with AJ down and being counted. Then he gets 50 odd seconds on his seat to get instructions. Then he stands up for the start of the fourth. So suddenly now we're into 67, 66 seconds of my 80 right. seconds. And then he goes down really early, like maybe the third or fourth second. Then he gets up and there is mayhem. There's bedlam in the arena. There's bedlam in the ring. There's nobody sitting at ringside. He then goes over again, but it's ruled a slip or a push by the referee, who looks like he's waved the fight off. So the commentators around the globe in their various languages are all saying, the fight's over, the fight's over. Then they go, no, it's not. Now, I think all that happens, he goes on the floor three times and has a 55-second break all inside 80 seconds. That, to me, I've never seen a fight like that. And I take on board Mike's point that a great fight involves two men and a fight going both ways. Mm. But that particular 80 seconds, that might be one of the most extraordinary 80 seconds I've ever witnessed.
And what surprised me, Mark, certainly an element towards the end of the first round when he took a big right hand and went down. His hands were so low at that stage, and he'd been criticised when he came back from his two defeats against Alexander Usyk for being gun-shy and being too reticent. And it seemed like over the course of a run of four fights where the fear had subsided, but to the point where through the first round he was holding his hands very low, leaving his chin completely unprotected. And I found that really, really difficult to understand at that stage of a contest against such a potentially big hitter.
And Dubois was not only in the zone, to use a cliche, he just looked sharp, he looked focused, his jab was brilliant. I don't think he missed with a jab for the first three rounds. He didn't waste any of his right hands. He was aware that, you know, he's a big guy, you throw too many shots that don't connect or hit someone's arms or land in thin air, you're in trouble. He was conserving his energy, he was bullying AJ without physically having to push him around. But what's more, he was smarter than AJ. Now, of all the possible things that might have happened in this fight, nobody in their wildest dreams would have said smarter. So much of the build-up
we talked about
AJ's smartness.
Yeah, and that starts, if you look at that section of film, the last 10 or 15 seconds of the opening round, Joshua looks like a man who's already been down four times, and this is like the 12th round, and he's trying to hold on. The arms are low and the chin's in the air. And it's not to take away, Dubois absolutely took his chances, but it just surprised me that Joshua seemed to be so carefree as early as the first round.
Isn't it interesting how you measure great fights, I suppose? And I completely take your point on the ebb and flow. But I mean, I watched it with one of my daughters on Saturday night. I must have just kept saying, oh, my God. Yeah. Like, oh, my... like, two, three times every... Or, oh, my
or
God.
More, yeah.
Or more, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Five, six, seven times around. And if we watched it back in this room now as a watch-along, we'd be into massive double figures for how many times we thought the next punch would drop Joshua. I mean, he was dropped four times, a fifth time if you count that second knockdown in the fourth round. But he looked like he was going. He looked like he was going another 10, 20, maybe even 30 times. Let's get it it right. That's extraordinary.
But what I would say, though, is with the power that Joshua's had throughout his career, right up until his most recent performance against Francis Ngannou, which was described by one of my co-commentators at ringside as the greatest punch he'd seen thrown and the most dynamic and most punishing shot he'd seen thrown. So there was always that element there where you wondered whether Joshua, if he connects.
That's the fifth round, Mike. That's the fifth round. You've got to pull back, son. You've got to pull back.
All right, I'm going to take you there now. Right? So this is a bit of audio from the broadcast on Saturday night. The bell has just rung at the end of the fourth.
And now, Anthony Joshua guiding Daniel Dubois back to his red corner while he makes the long walk across the ring to the blue corner. Left listening to Ben Davison giving instructions to Anthony Joshua.
That's what it's about. Get through this. Warrior spirit.
100%.
But we've got to be smart.
Yeah, I am.
You rush stepping in with the jab almost every time unless you're galloping around. Step and bring it up. Yeah?
If that's a bit of a lull, in behind that double jab, bring it up. Roll the dice. He'll double another right time. Lift it, yeah?
I think that's dangerous advice there, to be honest. I mean, getting it to bring it up off the double jab. Daniel throws that right hand straight off that double jab. And by bringing it up, he means an uppercut. He's going to walk himself straight onto his short right hand. If you ask me, I'd just say keep your hands up tight, get through these next two rounds, and then use your athleticism late down the stretch.
Round five!
Shane McGuigan there, who was part of our commentary team, former trainer of Dubois.
Mm.
And that's how it panned out.
Yeah, superb analysis. But when they were saying in the opposite corner, roll the dice, and they've been criticised for saying that, if you actually look at the success that Joshua had immediately before the finishing shot, he lands two mighty right hands that I would contend, and I think there's a strong argument that those two right hands would have knocked out
any heavyweight
on the planet apart from Daniel Dubois. Mm. So in a sense, they were telling Joshua to go for broke, to roll the dice. He rolled them. The numbers didn't come up, but he would have got very close against any other heavyweight.
I was part of the TNT team on the night, and Carl Frampton, and I do love him to death, he said the exact same thing that Shane McGuigan said. He said the exact same thing at the exact same time. How can he be? And he was screaming. How can he be telling him to do that? But I just need to point out a little bit that's been maybe misrepresented online. It isn't Ben Davison who tells AJ to bring it up. It's a man called Lee Wiley who works closely with Ben. They're inseparable and they work very closely. It's him who tells him to bring it up. Now, the problem with an uppercut, that's the shot we're talking about, Chappers, is there's only certain places and at certain occasions when you can throw the uppercut. And a time when you can't throw it is when you've got a man trapped in a corner and you're standing in front of him. Because an uppercut doesn't travel as far as a straight right cross. And so you're out of range. If you throw an uppercut, it's going to be 8 inches, 10 inches short. It doesn't matter. You throw an uppercut as the man's coming to you, or if you're in really close, so your bodies are touching, and you bring an uppercut up. You can't physically land an uppercut from that position. I mean, Mike trained guys that went on to box at the Olympics, remember, in a former life. I mean, you think he's only 54. Trust me, he's 57 if he's a day. No, so in a previous life, he trained guys that won national titles, boxed for GB, and went to the Olympics. You can't physically throw that punch from that position, Chappers. It's an impossibility. It really is.
It might have been that they saw that uppercut as one of the key punches. He threw it
Components,
in the first round and he threw it in the third round, but he threw it after making Dubois miss. And I don't want to get too technical to a general audience, but Joshua waited for Dubois to throw a left-hand jab and then just dipped his right shoulder so that the punch went over his left shoulder, and then he whipped in a right uppercut. He did that twice. Both times it didn't just connect, but the fact that he tried that same move twice suggests to me that that was part of the game plan, that they saw maybe a weakness once Dubois throws that jab, leaves it there maybe, and they can get inside. Didn't work, but...
But Shane knew that because they would have done, you know, they were together for an awful, apart from the last three or four fights, they were together for an awful long time. And Shane absolutely knew that he'd worked on Daniel, if he's trapped on the ropes, letting that right hand counter go, watching the man's hands and throwing and countering over the punch. That shot should have been a punch over a punch, and it wasn't. Instead, it's AJ's hand is almost on his waist, and his right hand is below his waist. It's an open target.
There's still so much to get into on Five Live Boxing. Steve Bunce and Mike Costello are with us, and Frank Warren joins us live now. Daniel Dubois, promoter. Evening, Frank.
Good evening, chaps.
Had a very enjoyable 48, 72 hours?
Yeah, very, very enjoyable. It turned out as we expected and I think as we predicted.
You have witnessed a lot of big nights over the course of your life and your career. Is that up there? Everything that comes together. Yeah.
Without a doubt, 98,000 people in the place. It was a record audience. Unbelievable fight, and the atmosphere is just amazing. And the two guys give everything, and certainly everybody got entertained, and the star was born.
On the day itself, how was Daniel Dubois, and did he change at all as it got closer to going into the ring?
No, he was focused all the way through. Anybody who attended any of the press conferences or spoke with him, he was switched on, and that demeanor never changed one iota.
The way it worked, Chappers, hi, Frank, the way it worked is that all week long, we were waiting to see a crack, to see some sign that Dubois, the pressure was getting to him. We waited on Monday. We waited on Tuesday at Leicester Square. We waited on Wednesday when we were at this place. Then we waited on this place. We kept waiting. We kept waiting for Dubois to crack. And then on the night, we kept waiting for him to crack. Then we saw him come into the ring and start moving around. And Lennox Lewis and Carl Frampton were with me, and they went, Buncey, man, he looks so relaxed. He's loving this. So we were waiting all week for him to crack, and he never did, Frank.
Well, everybody underestimated him. I mean, nobody tips him at all, I don't believe, to win the fight. I always felt that it was a styles make fights, and I thought the style, AJ's style was perfect for him, and that's how it turned out. It was all about, as I said at the beginning, hang on one thing. Excuse me. Oh, it was all about the battle of the jabs for me, and whoever pushed his opponent on the back foot would win the fight, and that's what he did. He came out very emphatic, left hand, caught him the jab, snapped his head back, and that was the pattern of the fight until he got clipped. I think it was the round before, the penultimate round, he got caught with an uppercut, which he took. He did. I don't agree, Mike. It did connect. He did catch him on that, and he took it. And then at the end, I think when he went back to the corner, he said he was going to roll the dice, and that's what he had to do, because at that stage, all the knockdowns and the way he'd won the rounds, I think he was a good six or seven rounds behind. Mm. And cut a long story short, he came out and did that. He threw that right hand twice, and this one of them connected, tremendous punch, and Daniel took it. But once he lets that right hand go, he becomes vulnerable, and Daniel countered, which was always going to be the option. And as I said, and I did say, I'm not being a know-all, I did say whoever throws that big punch is who can take the shot, because the counter will be the answer to it. And the counter was there, and obviously he poleaxed him. And the first time AJ was properly knocked out.
And I was saying there, Frank, about listening into the corner at the end of the fourth round before what ultimately was the final round, and Don Charles saying, don't let him back into the fight. What were your feelings at that time, not knowing that the next round would be the last?
Well, I just felt that, I felt that he had to keep to the game plan. And the game plan was everything off the jab. Whatever you do, keep him on the back foot, because on the back foot, he's not the same fighter. As it turned out, he's an offensive fighter, AJ. And it wasn't like he was fighting Ruiz in the second fight, where he did get clipped in the fourth round and then he went on the back foot, because Ruiz never had any legs. Daniel's got, he's young and he's quite speedy. He's got fast hands. And he has got a good chin, and it was just keep the offense going, and that's what he did. And as we all see, that was the result. It was a perfect fight for him. Got caught a couple of times, but it's heavyweight boxing. That's what happens.
What happens now?
Well, I'm in a meeting now. I've had to come out and do this, which we're trying to get on with. And I'm going to have to leave you in a moment, and I'll answer that tomorrow.
A meeting about what's next for Daniel.
Correct.
Right.
Well, we're not doing one-word answers, are we?
No, you won't get any answer on that, because I don't know myself, and I need to get back in there, chaps.
Frank, can we ask if you can clear up whether or not and how the rematch, which people are talking about, how that might or might not work? Is that a dual rematch? Do they both have to agree?
Well, we have no contract for a rematch, and at the moment there's something we're discussing, and we'll see where we go.
Okay.
Okay, and just a final one on his commercial value now after a fight like that, that you know how it works, right? That all of a sudden that catapults him to a wider sporting audience, doesn't it? Frank?
Sorry, I lost you there.
I said, are you going?
Yeah, we're off. Right. I'll call you in the morning. Sorry about that, chaps.
Is that the meeting over, Frank?
Well, it is, and I'm going to have to leave you, chaps. So nice to talk to you and everything, and I'm trying to do some work here. I'll give you as much information as I can give you, and that's it. So
right, go on then.
Love you at last and leave you.
We'll love you leaving. I'm going back with a new superstar of world boxing and a superstar of British sport.
There you go. Frank, thank you very much. Frank Warren, Daniel Dubois, promoter. And who would he have been saying goodbye to? Then?
I've no idea. And if you think I'm possibly going to hazard a guess, it'll be a group of people in that room, and I could probably guess at two or three of them.
Okay. But this next point then, his commercial value and the kind of venues and fights that are now available to him, because there would still be. Would you still think that if Joshua got a fight in a certain stadium, he's more likely to fill it than Dubois, even after the other night?
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say yes because of the AJ effect. And that's not been something that was instant. You know, he was a golden boy leaving the Olympics. He turned professional with, I think, the most amount of pressure on his shoulder, more pressure on his shoulder than any other boxer in history. And I do believe that AJ, in a straightforward race against Daniel Dubois, would sell more tickets, only if there's a proper opponent. People aren't coming to see AJ against a couple of the guys he's beaten recently, Robert Hellenius and Otto Wallin. So AJ would have to, I'm going to use the expression that was multiply used between rounds, AJ would have to really roll the dice. And he would have to really roll the dice. However, I think that Dubois, I didn't see Mike on Saturday because it was absolute chaos. So the first time I saw Mike was when we got here. So Mike, I haven't even asked you. If you're managing Dubois, what would you do? Because I know what I would do with Dubois. Right. What would you do?
I would wait for the winner of Fury and Usyk at Christmas time, the rematch, and then go for
that guy.
Go for the winner of that and become undisputed. I think there's every chance after the confidence that he will have grown with after that performance on Saturday night. He can go against either of those with a great deal of confidence. I know it's only 13 months since he was beaten by Alexander Usyk, but I'm getting the impression that this is a different fighter. I mean, 4 years ago, he was beaten by Joe Joyce, went to the canvas in the 10th round, was lambasted for quitting. Frank Warren would have told us there, if we'd gone on to this, that, look, he damaged nerves and the bone around the orbital socket. So, you know, he had reason to go down. Maybe he was disorientated. But last year against Alexander Usyk, compared to what he took on Saturday night, he was floored by a fairly innocuous-looking jab from Usyk, went down and took the full count. It's hard to reconcile that.
That man with this man.
With the man who took those heavy, heavy shots on Saturday night. And I've been thinking back to one of the great legends of the sport, Roberto Duran, who the likes of Ricky Hatton regard as his all-time idol. He was involved in a famous, infamous fight in 1980 against Sugar Ray Leonard. It was a rematch of a fight earlier in the year, which Duran had won. And in the rematch, he just turned around in the 8th round and it became known as the No Mass, No More fight. He just turned around and said he didn't want it. And you'd think that that would be an indelible stain on his career. But Duran remains one of the great, great heroes to boxers and fans alike. And it might just be that over time now, those two so-called blemishes, the two defeats on the career of Daniel Dubois, will be erased in terms of the damage done to his reputation by what he's done. I mean, this run of three fights when he beat Jarrell Miller, Filip Ergovic, and now Anthony Joshua, that's a run that not many heavyweights in the world can match at the moment.
That's three fights against two men who are undefeated, where he started as an underdog or a big underdog in all three of them. And he was matched very hard as a test. And I had a conversation with Frank Warren in September. We went out, we made a pod in his house in the garden. It was lovely. It was very early September, about 2 weeks after the bizarre fight with Usyk, where he seemed to sort of half turn away from a jab and take the count on his knee, the full 10 count. And off the record, then on the record, Frank said, no, I'm going to have to sit with him and have a chat and see really what Daniel wants to do, because it's no good me matching him if this is, you know, if in crucial hard moments this is going to happen, or words to that effect. And so he did have a hard chat with him. And so when he was matched with Gerald Big Baby Miller at Christmas in Saudi Arabia as part of the Riyadh season, I mean, people were generally going, well, you know what? He's not being spoon-fed. He's being thrown proper deep in. And he stopped him with 8 seconds left in the 10th of a grueling hard fight. So hard was it in about the full fourth, fifth, that Daniel's dad, who we just called Dave, even if his name is not Dave, everyone just calls him Dave. Dave had to come to ringside. Frank Warren got Dave to ringside, and Dave held like the second rope and was howling at Daniel through the ropes to get his act together. Dave saved that, in my opinion. Dave saved Daniel in that fight. So basically, Mark, what we're seeing is a guy that's come back from two astonishing losses, and his reputation, especially after Saturday night, forget it. It's fantastic.
But how then? How did? I mean, you're sort of suggesting a little bit that he's had a stern talking to.
Yeah.
Is it simply that? Is it? I mean, we've had these. Look, boxers should be allowed to lose fights. I suppose it depends how they lose fights. But and people change and people develop and people become different over the years. But is it, from both your perspective, is it simply, look, if you want to do this, come on.
Yeah. Look, part of this is about the Warriors code, and the way he was beaten by Joe Joyce and Alexander Usyk didn't sit well with mainly ex-fighters. They're the ones that were saying he quit. Yeah. We were doing a podcast together at the time, and we got absolutely lambasted because we said we're not going to attach the label quitter to him because we've not been in there and done
at that level,
what these people do. The ex-professionals can do that, and they did that
did
in
they
waves.
Ever?
But he's managed to come through, and as I say, like Roberto Duran, and when people look back at his career now, there's still a great degree of adulation there, and certainly what Dubois has done in these last three fights is being very effective in starting to wipe away those memories. Now, just before you go on, Steve, I wanted to just introduce this clipping I've got, Mark, from part of my research at the weekend. And it's a column from Boxing News, known as the trade paper in this country, from March of 2015. So it's getting on for 10 years ago. Cool. And it's a column written in Coach's Corner by a guy called Mick Delaney, one of the greatest amateur coaches this country has known. And he's the coach at the Dale Youth Amateur Boxing Club, not a long way from...
It was in the basement of Grenfell. And when the fire took place, they had their premises destroyed, their new premises destroyed inside.
So Daniel was there at the time when the gym was at the foot of the Grenfell Tower. And this is just a brilliant journey back in time to where Daniel was in 2015. So he'd have been like 17, 18 maybe. You can tell, I think, says Mick Delaney, who also coached James DeGale and George Groves, who went on to become world champions. You can tell, I think, he says, within a year, if a boxer has got something special. With DeGale and Groves, you could tell from their first junior bouts they were going to be special. Now we have a super heavyweight, Danny Dubois.
Danny, I like Danny.
Who had a win in Durham at the Youth Championships, a national competition at the weekend. He's already a potential GB podium squad member up in Sheffield. He's going to be something special. He weighed in at the weekend at over 102 kilograms. He's a huge lad. A lot of people are saying he's going to be another Anthony Joshua. He's very heavy-handed and he's a good boxer with it. It's a long way to go, but if he keeps his feet on the floor and behaves himself, I think he can go as far as Joshua. Believe me, all over Wembley and all down Wembley Way, Olympic Way, whatever it's called on Saturday night, there would have been people saying, I knew Dubois would come back. I knew he wasn't a quitter. But believe me, this guy was in near the birth.
Yeah, but Mick Delaney's got the proof in that article. Wow. And I remember Mick Delaney and George Groves talking about him, certainly in sort of just before he turned professional, which was in 2017. First time I saw him as an amateur in the national championships up in Sheffield in about October, November of 2016. And there'd already been a lot of talk about him at that point. He was going to be signing with Bob Arum. He's going to be signing with Don King. He's going to be signing with Matchroom. Frank Warren just held his fire. He kept his powder dry and signed him. Because Daniel Dubois, we said to forget this, before that Joe Joyce fight, which was right in the height of COVID, there was only about 60 people there. At that point, Dubois did turn pro with a lot of pressure. He wasn't anonymous. He was a star from the very first night. He turned professional on the same bill in Manchester that Nicola Adams was on, a double Olympic gold medalist, having her first fight. And it was a story of these two boxers who were going to rule the world. So Dubois was destined, and it got massively shipwrecked with that Joyce fight.
Two more questions, then we'll switch it on to Joshua. Did it help Dubois that in many ways everything over the course of the week and including the fight itself, he was treated as if he was the challenger?
I think it did, because it made him... It created a situation where he had nothing to lose. The two or three interviews that we did with Dubois last week that we did for Five Live, it was all about, you know, everyone thinks I'll lose. I've got pressure's not on me. I can just do what I like. And I think that made him a danger man. That made him fearless. And I know we're going to talk about AJ in depth in a moment, but I think the reverse of that is that I'm not absolutely sure, despite the sound bites, that the team AJ treated Dubois with the respect he deserved. Frank Warren hinted at it there when he said everybody. I mean, Frank was like an outlier last week. He was on his own. You know, even people that you thought might be neutral weren't neutral. It was all about AJ.
And in terms of the label champion, Mark, I think it's really important that Dubois did what he did on Saturday night, because yes, he was introduced by Michael Buffer as the reigning IBF champion, but he hadn't won a world title fight. Yeah. You know, he won an interim fight, and you know, you've got to be involved in the craziness of boxing to understand what that nonsense means. But winning that fight on Saturday night, I think, would have been really important to him and everyone around him to really establish himself as a champion. I remember that, you know, it can really depend on who you beat. When Joshua won that same title first time around against an American, not a good American, one of the worst world champions ever, Charles Martin. And I went up to him at the next media event before his next fight a few months later, and I just said, "How you doing, champ?" And he said, "Don't call me champ." And sorry to explain, you know, the level of opposition doesn't warrant it. And then when he beat Vladimir Klitschko in one of the great fights of all time, one of the great sporting events at Wembley of all time, then after that I said to him, "Now can I call you champ?" And he said, "Yes." And I think Dubois, after that on Saturday night, even though he went to the ring with the belt, will now genuinely feel like a world champion. And as I said, look, it might not be next, but he genuinely belongs in that arena. What? Yes, he was beaten by Alexander Usyk, but I think we're seeing a different fight.
And that was going to be my follow-up question, which is probably the harder one to answer, given anything can happen in this sport. Why wouldn't it be Fury or Usyk next for him?
Because in terms of promotion, they might want to let it simmer and to really build it into an even bigger event. I mean, let's say, for example, and he is a narrow favourite, it's Alexander Usyk, wins again against Tyson Fury. Then you've got the rematch. And still, I would wager that Usyk would start favourite again, depending on his performance against Tyson Fury. And bearing in mind he's 37 years of age, with a long, long career behind him in the amateur ranks as well as the professional ranks. He won a gold medal at London 2012. Mm. So that is possibly a move. And I think there is a danger that he misses out on that monster fight. I mean, you know, for how long have we been talking about Anthony Joshua against Tyson Fury? Is that now going to be consigned to the list of great fights we never saw?
Yeah, I think there's still a thirst and an energy, and there's certainly the cash to make that happen. And one of the things,
Fury Joshua.
Yeah, yeah, I still believe there is. I absolutely believe there is.
But then if Fury loses to Usyk, and then we end up with Fury Joshua, it's just a It's like a legends fight.
Well, it's a legend.
I mean, I don't know.
Well, it may be, you know, maybe you could classify it as a legends fight, but my gut feeling is, hey, listen, what we want to see is we want to see AJ coming off a knockout win in a world title fight and Fury coming off a knockout win in a world title fight. So we have to build a stadium that can seat 250,000. If we can't build that stadium, having waited 4.5 years from when we were told on June the 10th, 2020, that this fight is made, that's what Fury told us and that's what everybody tended to agree. I still think that fight does amazing business.
But why do you want to see Joshua Fury if Joshua's just been knocked out by Dubois?
It's not a case of me wanting to see it. It's a case of me absolutely believing it would sell. I want to see Dubois against Fury. I want to see Dubois against Usyk, a different warrior mentality. Yeah. Dubois, of course I do, but I think it won't. One of the things I think might happen with Dubois, Mike, and I didn't discuss this with you earlier, is that what about if you build Dubois? What about if you stick him inside the new Co-op Arena in Manchester, 25,000. You'll sell every ticket like that. What about if you then stick him inside the O2 in September? You'll sell every ticket like that. He'll still only be 28 years of age. He'll be 7, 8, 9 and 10 years younger than the three other heavyweights that are out there. So there's that to it as well. So those super fights aren't going away. For instance, Joshua, Fury and Usyk are probably not going to retire in the next 9 months. Dubois could have two enormous fights. Two enormous fights. I think there'll be enough public love for him. That's one option. Frank Warren might be throwing things at the car radio now, disagreeing completely. In fact, he might even call you up to disagree. But that's what I could see that happening, because I still think we're going to see Fury and AJ. I really do. I'm sorry. Win or lose.
And I can understand that. And that I think speaks to mentality, Mark, and maybe how we all have to change, because we've been so enamoured by the unbeaten record and generally the records of fighters. You go back to what's always remembered as the golden era of heavyweight boxing, with Foreman and Ali and Frazier and Ken Norton in the 1970s. So Joe Frazier gets bounced around the ring by George Foreman. George Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle gets beaten by Muhammad Ali. So if Muhammad Ali's beaten George Foreman, why do you want to see Muhammad Ali against Joe Frazier? In 1975, Thriller in Manila might be the greatest heavyweight fight you've ever seen. So we've got to get back to that mentality that fights are fights. And even if they both lose, it's almost like you've got the two winners and the two losers of the semi-finals meet forward, that they are such huge personalities. I've always said about heavyweight boxing and the big, big fights, they're like exotic holidays, that part of the deal is looking forward to them in the build-up and talking about them afterwards.
Let's hear from Anthony Joshua next. This is what he posted on his social media channels today.
We came up short. But look, we've got to look at all the positives. That's the mindset and that's the perspective that we have to have. A positive one. Always. Look at what we've achieved in the space of 11 years. It's phenomenal. And I want to thank every single one of you that's been riding with me. What a roller coaster journey. But you know what the problem is? Is that it's far from over yet. Done it once. We've done it twice. Doing it a third time hasn't been easy. But I believe it's something I can achieve. It's about making the right steps forward, working hard, improving, and it's got to come from here more than anything. It can't come from any external voices or influences. It's got to come from here. And it's only been a day, but when I sit back and I'm thinking, I know I've got a lot of this, man. I know I've got a lot of this. So, yeah, just a video to say thanks for your support. Thanks for being on this rollercoaster journey with me. Keep your seatbelts tight, because deep, deep, deep down in here, I know we've got a lot more to bring, a lot more to bring to the game. And long may it continue. British boxing, I appreciate you. We rise up together. Let's go.
So that's what Anthony Joshua posted on his social media channel. Shortly after the fight, Bunsey spoke to Joshua's promoter, Eddie Hearn, and Hearn explained what the future could look like.
We've got another fight with Riyad Season, and I know he's going to want another shot at Daniel Dubois. But look, if Tyson Fury wins against Usyk, if Tyson Fury loses against Usyk, we've got to look at that fight as well. But AJ will be back. He's very frustrated right now, because no excuses. Great camp, felt fantastic, really confident. We knew Dubois would be a handful in the early rounds. Unfortunately, we made mistakes and never had the opportunity to recover, nearly. And, what could have been in the fifth round. But, you know, big credit to Daniel Dubois. I thought he was fantastic tonight.
Is this the toughest night you've ever had, Ed? I mean, I thought Ruiz was bad and one or two other nights.
No, because, you know, we've been here before, and I think your nerve endings just become burnt out. So you know, I'm not chilled at the moment. I'm gutted. I'm gutted for 80.
I can tell, yeah.
But, you know, the defeat to Ruiz was far more brutal. You know, tonight, we knew this was going to be a very dangerous fight, and we lost to a very good young heavyweight who deserves all the credit. But more importantly, it's the way that AJ not just conducted himself after the fight, but the way that he just never quit. You know, at times, the second and third round, hard to watch.
Yeah, it was hard to watch.
Because he just wouldn't, you know, it's like, but he went out on his shield. And that's what you want as a fight fan. And you want someone that will go out on their shield. And he did that tonight.
And finally, I know you went to see him after the fight. You just thought you got with me, you were with him. How was he in there?
Actually, okay. Gutted. And kind of like kicking himself because of the mistakes that he made. You know, and he knew he made the mistakes and he knew he couldn't have got off to a worse start. But, you know, a lot of people around him just saying, like, to be honest with you, it couldn't have gone any worse and you still could have won the fight. So, you know, all you can do is give credit to the opponent and work hard and come again.
Can't disagree with any of it, can you, from either of them?
He was very emotional. I mean, his eyes were... His eyes weren't great. He looked like he'd been in a bit of a state. I spoke to AJ after that. I hope we're not going to play it because I've just previewed it. But he was really focused on that last round, the round we still haven't discussed. And he was really focused on what he did wrong in that round. He'd watched it, Mike. He came out, then he went back in. He said, waved, said, I'll do you. Then he went back in for 5 minutes. And I think he watched that last round several times. On that last minute and the end of the fourth and the last round. And so, because he knew exactly what he'd done. Now, if he'd been knocked out, which he had been 30 minutes earlier, Mark, he wouldn't have been able to detail exactly what he did wrong. And he got it punch perfect, Mike. Every punch he threw in the last 15 seconds and every punch Dubois threw in the last 15 seconds. And he knew exactly the mistakes he'd made. I mean, they're building a case there, and bear in mind, that's not half an hour after the fight. They're building a good case there for a rematch and a bit of revisionist history. Let's get it right.
But Frank Warren said there's no clause for that to us, didn't he?
Yeah, but if there's a market for it, you know, I've said so many times that the governing body of boxing, the real governing body of boxing, is money. And if the money's there, then they'll do it again. And if they recognise that the clamour's there, if they get the feeling that the clamour is there for them to do it again, then they will go again. And the Joshua camp and some fans will lean on those successes he had in the fifth round.
Absolutely.
Very close to the finish, and believe that if he's a little bit more disciplined next time around, that maybe there'll be a different result.
Do you want him to keep going? Does he need to keep going? What would be next for him, for you?
I wouldn't go into mourning if I didn't see him in a ring again because of how much he's done for this sport. And I don't want to see him getting knocked around the ring. Now, listening to him there, he believes that there is more to come. I just look back through the history and don't see many examples of somebody hit and hurt so often coming back better after a defeat like that. Psychologically, however upbeat he might have sounded there, and physically, those were heavy, heavy punches across that fight. And again, going back to what he's done since he won that Olympic gold in 2012, and the old phrase that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, his impact on the sport has been monumental. And I just don't want to see that fall into disrepair.
You know, it's 6 or 7 stadium fights, Mark. It's nearly 500 million people have paid to watch him in those fights. It's about another 6 or 7 massive sellout fights around the country, you know. Now, I don't know, but I'm not sure if any boxer in the last 50, 60, 70 years has been watched by that many people. Because you've got to have an awful lot of 20,000-seat stadiums to match a 90,000 against Klitschko, to match a 66, a 78, a 78, and then a 98 the other day. You know, you've got to have an awful lot of stadium fights. So certainly no British fighter in the last 50 years has come close to those kind of statistics. And it's not just that. It's from the grassroots up. It's all the work he does, all the money he ploughs into amateur boxing clubs and amateur boxing initiatives. And it's just the fact that everyone, even people that dislike him, even people that don't work with him, promoters and managers and trainers, they all acknowledge that we are where we are now in this boxing business in Britain, ruling Absolutely. And part of that is down to the AJ effect since turning professional in 2013. That's not me being dramatic. That's simple.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues for him might be what we covered in a documentary that we made on Five Live in 2009, all about how difficult it is to retire from boxing, called Life After Boxing. And Barry McGuigan said that adulation is like an A-class drug. And when you walk to the ring like Joshua did in front of 96,000 people and in front of 500,000 people across a spell of fights in stadiums, then that's really hard to walk away from. Barry Jones made a good point on the podcast you did immediately after the fight when you were talking there to Eddie Hearn and to Anthony Joshua, saying that boxing at the moment is Anthony Joshua's identity and it's so difficult to let that go. It's been his identity for so long.
And what I don't want to see him do, Mark, is walk away today and come back in 12 months or 13 months or 15 months because the offers are so immense. But like Mike, I don't want to see him beaten like that again, and I don't want to see him box an opponent that he can easily beat. So it's a bit of a quandary. It's a bit of a dilemma. And I tell you what, inside the AJ business, there'll be serious discussions. It's not a gung-ho business.
And too many, Mark. I've said it before. There are three key elements here: health, wealth, reputation. Too few boxers leave the sport with all three intact.
Boxing at the moment, me and Bunty had a conversation maybe 2 years ago, maybe
about then, yeah.
About it felt the heavyweight division was so difficult to understand and confusing and a bit of a mess and complicated. It feels as though it's been completely turned on its head over the last year, maybe.
You've got these four names now, and I was saying earlier on, it's been like semi-finals, Alexander Usyk against Tyson Fury, and now Anthony Joshua against Daniel Dubois. And between them, those four names have absolutely revitalised the division. And that performance by Dubois on Saturday night has only generated yet more excitement because he's 27 years of age. And as Steve said, it might be 2 years before the rest are gone, but you've got Usyk, who's 37, Tyson Fury is 36. Next month, Anthony Joshua turns 35. It won't be too long in the future that they're gone. And then Daniel Dubois has got the chance then to dominate and to become a very, very dominant heavyweight that's remembered for much more than he is at the moment.
Do you think it helps as well that the money involved means that the fights are everywhere now? There's no more, oh God, I missed that. I didn't know it was on. Whereas, you know, the fight the other night, Sky, TNT, DAZN,
all
working together, us and Talk, both did the commentary.
And that's happening in the States as well. Yeah. You know,
everybody's working
on it
as well.
No, I'm with that promoter, therefore I can't fight on that channel, or we're not going to make that work because they won't work with them. Or
Chappers, we have a 60-year solid history of great fights not being made. Before that, they had to get made because there was no TV or radio revenue streaming into the sport, or not as much. So, you know, up until the mid-60s, fights had to get made. From the mid-60s, certainly from the mid-70s and 80s, great fights didn't happen. We have had a terrible history of great fights not happening. In the last 25 years, it's been ridiculous. It's half a dozen of the greatest fights of all time. For instance, this is very recent time, Deontay Wilder and Anthony Joshua, they own the four heavyweight belts for 3 years and 3 months, and they never got within sniffing distance of fighting each other. If they both won a world title tomorrow, in some ridiculous Tuesday night show somewhere, they would be fighting inside 4 months. We wouldn't miss them after 3 years and 3 months. And now we've lost Deontay Wilder. He should never fight again, and we're not sure what's happening with Joshua. So we lost that great fight. We've got a fight coming up in Saudi Arabia in a couple of weeks between an unbeaten guy called Artur Beterbiev and an unbeaten guy called Dmitry Bivol. The type of fight that has fallen through the net and we've lost over the last 15 years that's been made possible. And they're being made possible by money. Let's get that absolutely right. These fighters aren't waking up one day and saying, you know what, I'll take a pay cut for risking it all against that dangerous fighter. It's being made because of money.
By Saudi money. Which then brings the criticism of human rights and sports washing as well.
Well, it does indeed bring all of those criticisms. A lot of the stuff we're hearing is stuff that we we've heard before. And it's really funny. We don't seem to hear that much when it's the F1 or when it's the tennis or when it's the golf or when it's the football. We seem to be picked on a little bit in boxing. The Saudis have invested heavily in the boxing program. They've also invested heavily in their domestic program. I went to a championship last year, the Riyadh Regional Amateur Boxing Championships. I told you this story, Mike. And in fact, I told a fancy PR firm this at a fight. I was in Saudi for a fight, and I told the PR firm they thought I was fibbing. When I walked in to this event, it was open to the public at a leisure centre on the outskirts of Riyadh. And I walked in, and I was walking in with a guy called Kevin Smith, who used to train boxers in Liverpool. He's now in charge of the Saudi amateur boxing team. Narrowly missed a couple of places at the Olympics. And as I walked in, he went, "Oh no." I said, "What's wrong, Kev?" He went, "Watch her." There was a woman in the ring. There was a woman boxing. Two of the three judges were women, and the referee was a woman. And the woman in the ring had just been, I think, disqualified. And she took off her head guard, right, and threw it through the head guard at one of the judges. So I went and sat down. 20 minutes later, there was another situation where it was another female boxing, okay, and she threw her shoe. She threw a shoe at somebody. So there's another side to Saudi boxing other than the one we've seen.
And what I would say, just so that people don't pile on you, I would. Jordan Henderson got an awful lot of pile on for on the football side of things, and the golfers who've gone to live have also got an awful
lot. Not as much as us, though, chappers.
An awful lot.
Not as much as us.
Very quickly, you're both up in Sheffield at the weekend. All British women's fight, Rhiannon Dixon against Terry Harper.
Yeah, and I think Rhiannon Dixon, it's a great story. She came to boxing late, worked as a pharmaceutical nurse during COVID-19, now boxing full-time and defending the WBO lightweight title. I think she's one of the rising stars of women's boxing. I think she'll win on Saturday.
Yeah, go on quick.
And Terry Harper's been a world champion already, but 4 years ago she was peeling spuds for 3 hours every morning in the local chippy. Get that, chappers. That's what I like.
Nice to have the band back together.
Isn't it?
Costello and Bonds here. Is this going to be a podcast? Is that allowed?
I think so. If you don't mind being on a boxing podcast with us.
No, I'm honoured to be on a boxing podcast with you. Johnny Anson in for Gordon Smart after Jill McKenzie in the latest news. It's 10 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Health officials in Lebanon say almost 500 people have been killed by Israeli airstrikes and more than 1,600 injured. Israel's defence minister said munitions belonging to Hezbollah had been destroyed in the strikes. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Daniel DeSimone, said the Israeli government was calling the operation a huge success.
They're saying they're going to keep going with this military campaign until they achieve their goal, which is to get 60,000 odd Israelis in northern Israel who've been displaced due to Hezbollah rocket fire. As we've seen, Hezbollah is still firing rockets, so that goal has not been achieved. That leaves a question about what next? What else is the Israeli military going to do?
The United States is sending a small number of additional troops to the Middle East because of heightened tension in the region. The Pentagon said it was taking the step out of an abundance of caution. Rachel Reeves has used her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to rule out a return to austerity in next month's budget. She stood by the cut to winter fuel payments for pensioners, insisting that tough decisions were needed. But she promised that Britain's best days lie ahead. Nurses in England have rejected the government's award of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said two-thirds of its members who voted turned down the deal. Harrods is starting an internal review looking at whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations relating to Mohamed Al-Fayed. A former employee told BBC News that a manager who failed to investigate allegations of inappropriate behaviour still works for the company. And a Northern Ireland politician who uses a wheelchair says he felt angry and let down when his plane to Belfast took off from Birmingham Airport, leaving him on the ground. Andy Allen, an Ulster Unionist MLA, said he'd booked special assistance, but no lift was available to help him board.
I was frustrated, I was angry. I felt let down because I had done everything required of me when I booked the flights. I made Aer Lingus aware that I needed the assistance, that I couldn't walk up the aircraft.